And I hear everybody say that things are different today. We're in lockdown. Or was it only yesterday? I saw you standing in the rain. And nothing's been the same since you came around. You came around, round, round, yeah. I've been walking on the sun. I just closed my eyes and then I'm gone.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Tools of Ignorance podcast. I am Hudson Malinsky. With me, as always, Jonah Bierenbaum. Jonah, how are you?
I'm doing well. Are we really already at episode 4?
Halfway to 8.
Yeah, the illustrious 8. I can't believe it. We're so accomplished, it sickens me almost.
Yeah, I mean, 8's a great number because it's a totally symmetrical number. And if we can get to 8 episodes, I have no words for how proud I will be of us.
Yeah, this is probably going to be the pinnacle of my career, is like episode 8. Like, that's sort of me peaking.
It's like the age 27 season.
Yeah. Or it's like age, it's like the 29 club for musicians, because that's, they reach their peak and then they die. Mm-hmm. It's like Kurt Cobain and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. And
was that 29?
I believe it's the 29 club, if my memory serves me.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense.
Who wants to turn 30? Like, your life just goes downhill from that point on.
Is Kurt Cobain, he doesn't deserve to be in the conversation with the others you just mentioned.
Well, you've just discredited yourself, so that'll be the end of the podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Hudson is fired. How could you even suggest that? Kurt Cobain's a legend.
Kurt Cobain is a whiny little girl.
All right, now we're saying things that can't be taken back. So, shall we? I think we should discuss baseball, lest I reach through my computer and assault you virtually.
Okay. The Detroit Tigers are going to the World Series.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about that. And considering the way that their starting pitchers have performed lately, it's conceivable that whoever manages to come from the National League, the Cardinals or the Giants, put up, like, you know, a combined 3 runs over, like, a 4-game series.
Yeah, they are on fire. Obviously, they just swept the New York Spankies. And it's something that you can just see happening with a team like Detroit that's so pitching heavy. That it's Justin Verlander it's not much of an argument, but, you know, there's an argument that he's the best pitcher in baseball. And, you know, that there's no one even close. I would argue Strasburg and then look and try really hard to find another one who's in that group. But Max Scherzer has been crazy good for the past couple months. Anibal Sanchez, obviously, a guy. I mean, it's just every day they can put out someone who can shut you out. And that isn't something that many teams have.
Yeah, sure. And, like, obviously, there aren't enough superlatives to describe Justin Verlander, and he really is in a tier of his own, like you said. But, yeah, Max Scherzer, like, since August, he's been equally as unhittable. Like, from August, September, and so far what he's done in the playoffs, you know, he hasn't had an ERA over 2.3, and his strikeout numbers are insanely gaudy. And frankly, that's just one of the more formidable 1-2 pitching tandems in baseball, if not the best. Of course, you could make a case for, like, you know, this year, like Strasburg and Gio, but, like, mm-hmm. Yeah, they were insanely dominant. And then to have Sanchez and Pfister and, you know, even a guy like Porcello, like, their starting pitching depth is extraordinary. And they just strike so many guys out. And, like, even on a night, it's amazing because Justin Verlander the other night, he only had, I think it was, 3 or 4 strikeouts?
It was 3, yeah.
Yeah, it was 3. And he still managed to go 8 1/3.
Yeah.
It's just remarkable how effective they were. I mean, they hucked their way to a 0.66 ERA in the ALCS against the New York Yankees, who's, you know, on a given day, who their 9-hitter is, like, I don't know, Jason, you know, Ichiro Suzuki.
Yeah,
like it was really remarkable what they were able to do, and, you know, Yeah, what are your thoughts on their bullpen? Because as effective as their starters were, their bullpen certainly did a job, although there was a little bit of turbulence there.
Right, right. And, I mean, that was kind of something you could see happening. They have options late in games, but Valverde, I can't pronounce his name apparently, but Jose Valverde.
Papi Grande
is a guy who, even last year when he had the perfect save conversion season, which, it's save conversions aren't necessarily a measure of success, but he was a guy who was pretty volatile. You could, on any given night, you could see people getting to him. And he was very, very good in 2011, but he was even more volatile this season, and probably some of that has to do with him aging into his mid-30s. But, it's a very difficult thing to predict, what's going to happen with, bullpen arms. Going with Phil Koch in certain situations and really never coming out and saying, who the closer was kind of, it looks like it worked out in their favor. They just played whoever was right for the situation. And here they are. The Yankees were never really able to mount a strong push against their bullpen. There were a couple of hiccups, but it was good enough, especially with how good the rotation was.
Yeah. I mean, you speak about using them in the appropriate situation. Like Phil Koch, I would have no hesitation putting him in against any left-handed hitter, because you look at his splits and he was extremely effective against left-handers this year. Like he worked his way to like sub 650 OPS against them.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of got torn up by righties, mm-hmm. which also begs the question, why didn't Joe Girardi pinch hit for Raul Ibanez in the pivotal game 3? That was sort of confounding to me, especially with A-Rod on the bench,
mm-hmm.
Nick Swisher, a switch hitter on the bench. But yeah, like I really like the way Jim Leland's used his bullpen, and I think it was very astute of him the way he managed egos, because he refused to say that Jose Valverde is not the closer. Like after Valverde gave up that bomb to Ibanez a couple nights prior, he came out to the media and he said, Jose Valverde has not been, he's not our closer. I'm just not going to use him tonight, which, that was like going into game 3 or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's good, because I think closers, to make a unfair generalization here, is that they can be sensitive. And if they feel that their job security is tenuous, they become, I don't know. It feels like maybe they get insecure about their job security at time, and I don't blame them for that, especially a guy who's as volatile as Jose Valverde. But yeah, I commend Jim Leland for the way he managed his bullpen in the ALCS. I mean, he did have the luxury of having starters go extremely deep into games, although, mind you, Scherzer only went like 5 2/3 today. But yeah, their bullpen was effective because Leland used them right. And just talking about Valverde a little, do you imagine that he'll sort of be reinstated as the closer next year?
I would imagine that he's going to be the top option, but I think there's definitely a scenario in which I could see the Tigers going in a different direction. I don't know of any good study that's looked at bullpen pitcher volatility or relief pitcher volatility, but I would venture a guess as to say that it's a much more difficult thing to predict because you're talking about much smaller samples. And so in any given month, he might be great, but in that same month, he might be terrible. And I think Joaquin Benoit.
Yeah.
He, when he first came over to Detroit, they signed him after a crazy good season with the Rays. And when he first came over, he had struggled rather clearly, and it was pretty bad. And you know, he's obviously struggled in different spots, but he's another guy who can be lights out. And there are just so many guys like that. So I would imagine that Valverde is going to be the guy, but it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's for me, it's always disconcerting when you see like a 34-year-old reliever, like a drastic decline in his strikeout rate, his ground ball rate. You know, these just aren't encouraging signs for a guy that you want to entrust the ninth inning to. He was, you know, he was pretty effective this year in save situations, but I mean, it's not overwhelmingly impressive to see a guy get three outs with a three-run lead, especially against some of the teams from the AL Central a disproportionate amount of the time. So yeah, I agree with you. I think that they'll go back to him, even though this playoffs was definitely a shake to his confidence. But it'll be interesting to see the way that Jim Leland manages his bullpen in the World Series, especially considering the fact that like the Cardinals lineup is replete with really good right-handed hitters. You know, guys like Holiday, Craig, Molina, Freeze. If he's still inclined to go with Phil Koch, considering how drastic his splits are and how ineffective he was against right-handed hitters this year. So I think it'll be very intriguing going forwards, and that the World Series will be compelling as always, regardless of whether or not the Cardinals or Giants make it there.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the Cardinals and the Giants, do we have a scoring update on that?
Yes, it is the middle of the sixth, and the Cardinals have a 4-run lead. Tim Lincecum has been lifted. Adam Wainwright continues to pitch effectively. He's given up one run over six innings. And George Contos has pitched one-third of an inning of relief, relieving Tim Lincecum, who I thought was going to be much more effective in his start. I was, the whole time when they were discussing whether or not to go with Zito or Lincecum in this game, the whole time I was a very fervent advocate of going with Tim Lincecum. But yeah, he didn't really impress me tonight. I thought that he would be better. But frankly, the Cardinals just have a lot of professional hitters. I look at their lineup and I just love the professional approach of guys like I said, Holiday, Craig, and Freeze just continues to impress me. So I don't know what your thoughts are on the series, but
yeah. I mean, I think the Cardinals are really, really good. And I'm going out on a limb and saying a team that's in the NLCS is really good. But I think they have a lot of players who will never, ever be household names that are very, very good and very effective. Guys like Freese and Jay and Alan Craig is a pretty good
player. I think it's a soft Jay. I think it's Yan Ye.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yan Ye. And Pete Kosma, you know, they group together these guys who are just solid big league contributors. And Daniel Descalso, and you know, it's
Matt Carpenter. He came in filling in for Carlos Beltran, hit a bomb yesterday, and he's got a double today.
A double and two walks. So you know, it's a team that's well built and built from within, and I really think that it doesn't surprise me. It just doesn't surprise me that they continue to win, and here they are now. If they can hang on tonight, they will be 5 wins away from another World Series ring.
Does it surprise you, however, that it looks like it's going to be the Giants' offense that spells their demise? Cue the dramatic music. Because a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how, in our minds, it was an error in judgment to keep Melky Cabrera off the playoff roster. And just looking at the playoff averages from Posey and Sandoval, do you think it's a decision they're regretting at this moment?
Well, I mean, I'd look more towards the averages of Hunter Pence or Gregor Blanco or the other outfielders on the team, because Pagan has been pretty good on the whole. But, you know, it definitely – I can't say definitely because I don't know how Melky Cabrera would have fared in a 4 or 5 game stretch, but – I just think, you know, people do this. You know, people cheat. It happens. And they serve their suspensions and they come back. And you should sort of forget about that, whether it's October 18th or whether it's April 18th. I don't care. I think you've served your suspension, and that should be that. Melky Cabrera is going to be a lot of fun to kind of follow as he enters free agency, as will Tim Lincecum. And I think that San Francisco is a team that's, if they, regardless of what happens in the next several days, they're a very difficult team to peg as far as off-season moves. What can they do? What will they do? And, you know, the farm system isn't great, but there's some talent there. So it's a very enigmatic team.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you have to think that they'll probably do something to bolster their lineup a little bit, just because, like, guys like, you know, Scudero and, you know, like, Brandon Belt continues to be disappointing, and, like, a lot of people feel that, well, he definitely did. Scudero has somewhat overperformed since coming to San Francisco. But it's interesting to me the way you phrased that. You said about Melk, you said, I don't care. Is that, I guess we're digressing a little bit here, but do you just not care about guys who use PEDs anymore? Is it just they become so ubiquitous that it's just like, okay, I don't care. Serve your suspension, come back and play, and I won't hold it against you.
Yeah, I mean, I have gone back and forth on this because I never really have had a firm stance either way. At this juncture, I just don't care. I think you serve your suspension, you come back, you play. Whether you deserve to be in the Hall of Fame or not is a different question. But, you know, I think we should just get over it and put you back in the lineup. If you're the best player, you should be on the field. And I think, it's unfair to the fan base to not use your best players. And it's unfair to the rest of the team, even, to not use your best players. I don't
do the Steven Strasburg outrage.
Yeah, exactly. It's essentially the same argument.
I wouldn't say it's exactly the same argument because
it's not the exact same.
There's profound differences in the reasoning and the rationale and the, you know, the impetus behind those decisions. But I understand what you're saying, and it is. I mean, if I was a Giants fan, I would be much more outraged at management's decision to keep him off the roster than Melky Cabrera's decision to use performance-enhancing drugs.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, there are a couple of things we can kind of transition to. On the theme of enigmatic teams and situations. And the first one I want to talk about is a player who makes a lot of money and does so for the New York Yankees. Or for now does it for the New York Yankees. And that is Alex Rodriguez.
Who?
Is Alejandro?
Is he some sort of baseballer?
He's a baseballer. He plays third base. He has a lot of home runs in his career. Not as many this year or in the past couple of years. But, he's got a lot of money left on his deal. And the past several weeks have been terrible for him. And it seems like the Yankees basically said, you know what, we're not putting up with this anymore. We don't care whether you're upset about not being in the cleanup spot. Maybe you're good enough to play for us, that type of thing. We don't care how much money you make. Can this team and can the player come back from that? Can you go into another season with A-Rod as the third baseman? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you can, but I think you need to go in there with the understanding that, he needs to go in there with the understanding that they are not, like, his right to play third base every day for the New York Yankees is not inalienable. Mm. And you're absolutely right. And it's very refreshing to see a team that is sort of putting performance ahead of economics, saying that they're prepared to bench a guy who makes, $30 million a year, because that's rare. And there certainly aren't a whole lot of precedents, especially with future Hall of Famers. Well, although that, I guess you can dispute with the whole PD thing, but we digress. Yeah, I think that if I were the Yankees, I wouldn't. I think it's difficult because I still think that A-Rod can play at a reasonable level. Mm-hmm. I mean, even this year, he missed 40 games and he was, you know, he was above average with 2.2 wins above replacement. But yeah, I think that he's got ability left, but certainly he needs to go into the next season with the understanding that his status with respect to playing time will, like everybody else, be determined by performance and contribution and how effective he is playing every day. And he needs to know that if he doesn't hit, he's not going to stay in the lineup. We're seeing a lot of these A-Rod to the Miami Marlins rumors surfacing. And do you really think that there's any truth to those rumors?
I would guess is that some beat writer asked somebody who was with the Marlins or the Yankees, would you send him in the right deal? And the person from the Yankees or the Marlins said, yeah, in the right deal, that would be great. And so a lot of these stories seem to come from that. And I don't necessarily think that there's any, I'm not saying it's not true, but I'm saying it's unlikely that it's true. I mean, it just doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense for the Marlins, who would presumably have to take on lots of money, in order to acquire A-Rod. Although the Yankees would probably eat a lot of it, but, nonetheless, the Marlins have said that they're going to cut their budget or trim the budget at least significantly from this season, because they were supposed to make a lot more money with their new stadium and everything was supposed to be jolly and they were supposed to win 159 games this year and two World Series in the same season. But, you know, it just didn't work this year. And I don't think adding money to the payroll and adding a player of, you know, who's declining, a player who is clearly declining and is going to be 37 next season is the right move for them. The only thing I can consider conceive is that, I'm not picking the right words, but what I'm thinking is that if somebody trades for A-Rod and eats a lot of the money, the Yankees are going to have to give up a lot more than just A-Rod. They're going to have to give up prospects. And so I point to teams who are sort of at the bottom of the barrel, but have a little bit of money. I would look at like a team like Houston, who could be looking for prospects. A team like maybe even Boston, which would be unlikely, but Minnesota.
The universe would explode if that transaction was actually consummated, I think.
That would be so awesome.
Yeah.
And then if he just like hit 70 home runs again, or not again, but if he came back, New York would hate him forever. But maybe the Cubs or, you know, just a team that, you know, that has some money and, you know, can make a deal and, you know, could get some prospects out of that deal and could also flip back a serviceable third baseman to the Yankees. And I think that would be good for the Yankees, to get past that. The question there then is just who plays third base long-term or, you know, really even just next year, you know, with Chavez being sort of uncertain. So, you know, there's a lot to be planned there, but I'm really excited to follow the mania that's going to be A-Rod.
Yeah, well, it's already well underway. Mm. And Eric Chavez was darn good this year.
Yeah.
I mean, he only had 278 at-bats, but, I mean, he had the best OPS since 2004. Mm. Like, he was extremely effective as a third baseman, as a, I guess, a sort of stopgap injury replacement third baseman. But, mm-hmm. You know what's interesting? Because A-Rod definitely – the fans of New York certainly became disillusioned with A-Rod this postseason and probably during the regular season to an extent as well. But, of course, it's very easy when a guy goes 3-for-25 in the postseason and doesn't collect a hit off a right-handed pitcher. But do you think to a certain extent the vitriol that's sort of been spewing out of New York towards A-Rod is fueled by the media's – incessant A-Rod coverage?
Yes, but Vince Gennaro, who's the president of Sabre, does a lot of number stuff, and he actually looked at, in an attempt to sort of get a sense of whether there are certain players who are better in the playoffs, he looked at hitters' performances against the top pitchers in the game. And A-Rod, what he found has, over the years, has been pretty you know, average or below average against the top 40% of pitchers. But when you look at the bottom of the barrel in terms of pitching, and he looked at pitchers by their OPS against, I believe, and against that bottom 60%, A-Rod mashes, and he's always mashed. And so he's been a guy who can get you out of the game if you're not all that good. So it makes sense that he would struggle in the playoffs because of that, because teams are using their one and two starters, and the teams in the playoffs presumably have the best pitching and all that. So I think it's definitely fair to blame A-Rod, or not to blame A-Rod, but to... I mean, to look at him for what he is, he's just not a very good player against top competition. And the New York media is going to crush you for that, and everyone is going to get crushed. You know, people will question whether Joe Girardi should still be managing this team. You know, that's just the type of thing that happens every day in New York. But I do think it was a little bit overblown, but, you know, A-Rod needed to perform, and he didn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I'm referring to is also, like, you look at that New York Post article that was expounding on reports that A-Rod was flirting with a couple of girls. I think it was in the middle of Game 3. Jeter went down in Game 3, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was in the middle of Game 3 that he was...
Was it Game 3 or was it Game 2? It was Game 2 because it was the extra innings game.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what I'm talking about, right? That's just sort of adding insult to injury and compounding already, you know, the huge amount of negative press that A-Rod had been getting with respect to his performance.
True.
So, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. A-Rod is definitely, he's brought this upon himself. I mean, over the past 2 years, he has 5 hits and I think it's like 43 playoff at-bats. So, yeah, and there's definitely credence to that hypothesis that he doesn't really hit against premier pitching.
Yeah, but the Yankees going forward are kind of mysterious because what happens with A-Rod and Jeter is and Cano and Nick Swisher and what's going to happen in the rotation with Andy Pettit or you know there are so many mysteries going on. I believe Hiroki Kuroda was also a 1-year deal. So there's a lot to be figured out in New York. And I'm kind of fascinated to see what they'll do.
Me too. I think that Swisher is gone.
Yeah.
You know what's funny? Because a bunch of people were suggesting that Swisher's disappointing postseason will somehow result in him getting a pretty poor contract offer, which I think is ridiculous because you look at the sample size and it's totally ludicrous to determine the monetary value or the length of a contract based on 30 at bats. But I think Swisher's gone. You never know with Andy Pettit. My instinct tells me he's gone. But then you also have, you know, you guys like Michael Pineda, who you anticipate will be back and hopefully, you know, he'll be effective. So yeah, the Yankees are sort of at a crossroads with a lot of aging talent. And then sort of a pitching rotation that's, I would characterize as suspect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to his credit, Phil Hughes had a couple good outings in the playoffs, and I like Hiroki Kuroda. But again, older guys, And yeah, they're sort of at an intriguing point because, you know, you have to think that with the talent they have in place, they're sort of reaching that point where they have to start making moves that are future oriented instead of now oriented. But yeah, that's sort of how I feel about the Yankees.
Okay. And so another team in the American League that was not a, well, they were kind of a playoff team, but the Texas Rangers did not play in an ALDS, and they were very good this season, and they didn't, you know, capitalize on it. And this is their third year of not capitalizing on a very good team. They have been to back-to-back World Series before this year, and they're a very difficult team to peg also because the Josh Hamilton thing that's going on, the rotation certainly has some issues that need to be worked through, and Jurickson Profar is pretty much ready to go, it looks like, and as is Mike Ault. And they are a very difficult team to peg. But for you, I mean, of all of the decisions that need to be made in Texas, does one really stick out to you?
Well, yeah, I think the one that will certainly have the most impact on the direction of their ball club is whether or not they decide to make a reasonable offer to Josh Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
My instinct tells me that they don't want to sort of – I think that to a certain degree they kind of want to sever the ties with Hamilton because, I mean, everyone knows the risks that are associated with investing huge amounts of money to him.
Yeah.
And you look at his age, right? And Hamilton is – there's no question that he's remarkably talented, but you look at some of his other numbers and his approach is frustrating. He strikes out a ton. He's prone to chasing a lot of balls outside of the zone. And you have to imagine that as he gets older, his raw abilities will only take him so far. And his the total absence of an approach and certainly a plate discipline are going to catch up to him once his abilities start to decline. So, yeah, I think that that's the decision whether or not to make a substantial offer to Josh Hamilton is the biggest one. But also, yeah, I'm so tempted to cue the they don't know how to win narrative to explain why they've gone to the World Series two times in the past 3 years and haven't won, and they, you know, they were leading the AL West for 5 months and 4 weeks minus one day, mm-hmm. you know, this year. But yeah, again, like you, I think that there's a lot of rotations there's a lot of questions with respect to the rotation. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Darvish was as dominant as perhaps people expected him to be. You know, Feliz is still going to be rehabbing that Tommy John for a period of next year. So, yeah, I don't know. What sticks out to you?
To me, it's the rotation. I think Yu Darvish is a guy who we can reasonably expect to take steps forward. With him, it's going to be the walk rate and trying to drive that down a little bit. But after him, it's just not clear. There's no clear two. There's no, I mean, it's just so difficult to peg the rotation. I think Matt Harrison had a really good year. But Matt Harrison is probably a three. And I would say Derek Holland's probably a three type of pitcher. And is that okay? If Colby Lewis comes back healthy, or if Neftali Feliz can come back healthy, is that going to be enough? Another kid, Martin Perez, a very, very promising prospect, but has you know, kind of been stagnating from year to year. He seems to struggle to adjust the next level every time he's promoted, but and he's kind of more of a wild card than a sure thing. To me, this is a team that seems to be always in a position to spend money. I'm not exactly sure why or how, but I think they're going to probably make a run at one of the top arms in free agency, and one of those top arms will be Zach Greinke. And I think that Zach Greinke could actually have a huge impact on next year's postseason because he's going to, you know, his decision as to where to sign is going to dramatically shape, not only could shape the AL West very differently, but it could also, you know, say he signs with the Yankees or the Rays, not the Rays, but, you know, he could do something that's crazy. Anything he does will have an impact. And so he's going to be a fun guy to keep an eye on. But as far as the Rangers go, Josh Hamilton, it's just, he's so good. He really is so good. Yeah. And he does have flaws and he is 31 years old, but the thing with him is if you let him walk and he hits 60 home runs next year and he bats 350, you're the team that let him walk. You know, there's a chance he will break and his career will be over in 2 years. That's a very real possibility, but being the team that lets Josh Hamilton walk is not going to be an easy thing to do.
Absolutely. And, my only thing is it's difficult to hit 60 home runs when you miss 40, 35 games a season, even as talented as Josh Hamilton is. And that's another thing, his extreme injury proneness, right? Mm-hmm. And all these things are going to factor into the decision, but you have to imagine that he'll command at least, 5 years? 6 years?
I don't know.
Right, because you know what? I don't know if the market, the free agent market, has ever encountered a case as fraught with potential complications as Josh Hamilton, because he is an extraordinary talent, but he's an extraordinary risk. And the question is, if
I don't know why this is happening.
Well, I'm sorry about always that. Down for a musical interlude. That's okay. And the question is, if Josh Hamilton ends up walking, does that sort of precipitate a whole bunch of changes that the Rangers make? Does Michael Young stop playing every day because, Mike Olt is there and Young is coming off, you know, probably the worst year of his career? Andrews, it's generally considered that Andrews' days are numbered with Profar waiting in the wings. So I'm curious to see if whether or not Hamilton's departure, if he does decide to depart, sort of sets into motion a new generation in Texas because, they went to the World Series twice in the past 3 years and they didn't win. Mm-hmm. And Josh Hamilton was certainly the lifeblood of that team.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they always had a deep offense, but
true.
I'm curious to see if his departure sort of has a widespread effect, so to speak.
Yeah, the one theory that was out there was mixing and matching some combination of Ian Kinsler, Elvis Andrus, and Dirksen Profar in the middle infield and center field. If and when Josh Hamilton walks, so you could move Kinsler to center field, or you could move Profar to center field, and it just seems like either one could work there, and you know still be very good there. But whenever you move a player to a foreign position, you do run the risk that you know they're going to not be able to adjust to that, or it's going to take a significant amount of time. And I think that it's just I really don't envy the person who has to make that decision, because either way, it could blow up in their faces.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm not, frankly, I know a lot of people are convinced that Ian Kinsler is destined to be an outfielder, perhaps a corner outfielder. I'm not so sure. I mean, for his career, he's an above average defender at second base. Josh Hamilton was certainly a liability in center field, and I think that it was never more apparent than in that final game of the season against Oakland, when his gaffe sort of opened the doors for the Athletics. But yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, I think that they're sort of at a position where they can take their personnel and sort of mix and match and put them sort of in a million different scenarios. So ultimately, the point I'm trying to make is that I think that it's going to be that decision, the Hamilton one, that determines sort of the course of their franchise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And with, you know, with not paying Hamilton a ton of money, it allows them more flexibility elsewhere. And I just think that of the off-season teams that we've discussed so far, you know, the Yankees, the Texas Rangers, and I think to a lesser extent the Giants, it's just going to be so much fun. It's just going to be an awesome December.
Yeah, it is. And that's even in spite of the fact that it's not the deepest free agent market mm-hmm. in recent years that we've seen. But yeah, I always get, I mean, as soon as playoff ends, I like literally the second that the last out is recorded, I switch into off season mode and it just gets, I get giddy with anticipation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the next thing we wanted to discuss, was, the manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, at least for the time being, the manager for the Toronto Blue Jays, John Farrell, and a possible transition to the dugout of a different AL East team, the Boston Red Sox, who Farrell has a history with. And there's been some little bit of chatter about him possibly making the switch. So you're a much more informed person in terms of the situation. So talk a little bit about that and what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the past couple of days, the speculation has sort of ramped up a few degrees, and it's definitely being fueled by the Boston media who have suggested that the Red Sox efforts to pry Farrell away from the Blue Jays have intensified and that they're beyond sort of the preliminary talk stage. And the thing I think that's sort of prolonging this whole thing is that Farrell hasn't really said that he's not interested in going to Boston. Whenever he's asked about it, the way he always phrases it is that my commitment is to the Blue Jays, I'm with Blue Jays. But he could sort of dispel all of the speculation in a second by saying, I am not interested in going to the Boston Red Sox. And he hasn't come out and say that. Certainly another thing that's making it even spicier is that Alex Anthopoulos had his he has a radio spot on the Jeff Blair Show, which is a local show on the Fan 590, which is a sports radio network in Toronto. He canceled it for tomorrow morning in the midst of all the speculation. So, of course, people took to Twitter to sort of fuel the speculative pot. And, yeah, with the combination of that, the Boston media, and now the Toronto media feeding off of those reports, there's a lot of steam to this rumor. I've heard names like Daniel Bard thrown around. Personally, I'd be pretty surprised if it was anyone on their 40-man that got dealt, if this deal does happen. But, yeah, I also think that it's foolish to suggest that the Blue Jays' willingness to trade John Farrell is indicative of the fact that they don't like John Farrell, because like any other person that, you know, you employ, you owe it to your fans to try to make your team better. If trading your manager for a substantial bit of player talent makes your team better, you need to pursue that avenue. And that's how I feel. And I like John Farrell. I think that, maybe there was too much of a laissez-faire attitude in the clubhouse this year, just by the fact that a lot of young guys were prone to making the same mistakes, particularly on the bases with guys like Lori and Escobar. And maybe there were perhaps more mental lapses than there should have been. But I like John Farrell. And having said that, if they were willing to move him for a piece that would make the team better, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really cool thing. We saw it last year with Theo Epstein going to Chicago and leaving the Red Sox. But the idea of compensation for executives and managers and treating them like they are a part of your team that makes you either better or worse. And I think that that's a really a really cool trend, or it would be a cool trend to see. So if we want your bench coach to be our manager, we'll give you our second baseman in Double A and things like that. I think that that would be kind of cool to see that happen in baseball.
Yeah, I mean, it's just value in another, you know, frame, I guess, if you want to put it like that.
Mm-hmm.
The Blue Jays are obviously weighing what is more valuable, a manager who's been here 2 years and developed a rapport with a lot of the players, or, you know, a potential arm, considering mm-hmm. the pretty abysmal state of their rotation going forward, considering all the injuries that they have.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me in the least if this is all just, you know, a spirited bout of rosterbation and, you know, the media fueling something that, you know, probably doesn't have as much steam as they've given it. But, you know, if John Farrell goes, then, you know, they hire another manager. You have a potential skipper, and, you know, there's certainly a lot of respect for Brian Butterfield around the organization. Sal Fasano's done a good job down in the minor leagues. And then there are, you know, there are external candidates. Manny Acta just got fired. Sandy Alomar Jr.'s name has been mentioned in quite a few potential managerial opportunities.
Mm.
So I think that a manager is relatively easy to replace. Acquiring high upside talent is not nearly as easy to come by, and you need to take that opportunity if it presents itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my spiel on John Farrell.
Awesome. Okay. So Jonah, we are. It looks like we're nearing the end of this podcast, but are there any more baseball-related subjects that you'd like to discuss?
Well, while we're sort of on the topic of Boston Red Sox and managers, what was your initial reaction when you heard that Bobby Valentine was fired?
Wow.
Touché, sir. I bet it was shock. You're like, how he did such an exemplary job this year that how could they possibly fire him? But yeah,
I was so surprised.
Can you believe they even waited like till the next morning? Like, do you think he got that? Like, literally, he's cleaning up the clubhouse on like the final day of the season, and he gets called into the office. Like, do you think it was that immediate?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, he seems like the kind of guy you couldn't tell him. I mean, you couldn't be like, hey, we're going to fire you in a couple days. Can you keep this quiet? Like, he's not the type of, doesn't come off as the type to just quietly let that happen.
He's not one to go quietly into that good night.
No, but he also, at least he seemed like he thought he was going to have a chance to stick around for next season. And I guess it would have made sense in terms of if you're going to be rebuilding, might as well do it, you know, without replacing the manager yet, mm-hmm. waiting for, you know, the best candidate to come along or something like that. I mean, so it was somewhat justifiable that he would come back, but it was.
Is it though?
It
really?
Was such a crap fest the entire season.
Yes,
in Boston. It was just ugly. And it just made too much sense for him to be fired. So Bobby Valentine, and I'm sure he'll be back in an ESPN booth, and he'll make some money, and he'll get to be around baseball still.
Now he has time to work on his Tim Kirchian impression, along with JPR and Sevilla, and I think it was like Dan Johnson or someone like that who had like their impersonations were rather respected around the league.
Yeah, well, Aaron Sibbia did the first one, and then he just started. Everyone started.
And his was the best. And I'm saying that totally objectively. Like, my bias is not showing through. His was the best.
Yeah, it was really, really good. I saw Tim Kirchian always has these like obscure facts, and I saw a meme yesterday that was like, "This is the first time ever that a game has an ALCS game 4 in which the home team could have swept on October 17th that a player who has over 600 home runs and was 2-for-29 in the playoffs didn't play."
Whenever, I mean, it's funny because whenever I hear statistics like that, I'm always reminded of Little Big League you know, that movie where Billy Haywood, he's like a 12-year-old and manages the Twins. Because their color guy, the Twins' fictional color guy in that movie, he would always go, and, you know, Joe Johnson hitting 350 after the seventh inning at home on nights after he consumed a hot dog. So that's something to think about.
Yeah. Kirchens, he has fun with it, but it's weird. It's certainly weird. I wonder if Tim Kirchens just like that in person. Like, if you just walk up to him, hey, Tim, how's it going? And he's just like, this is the first time in 27 years that I have been greeted by a person with black hair and thick eyebrows and brown shoes and whatever, you know. I think that would be hilarious if he was like that.
Can a human being actually be like that?
That would be so... I don't know. I mean...
If anyone could, Tim Kirchen could.
And we have a title for the episode. Okay, so non-baseball things. I didn't watch the third episode of Mad Men.
A pox on you.
Yeah, too much time had elapsed, and I kind of just... I started watching Community. I've enjoyed Community.
Are you marathoning Community?
I am marathoning. I'm almost done with the second season.
I loved the first season. Yeah. I wasn't quite as enamored with the second season, and I have yet to watch the third. I don't even know if there's a fourth.
I believe there is going to be a fourth.
Yeah, okay.
But I don't really know. But also today I indulged myself in some Pulp Fiction. For the first time, I watched Pulp Fiction. And it is a film that I have been told several times throughout my life that I need to see. And this wonderful invention called the internet allowed me to do so without spending any money. So I watched Pulp Fiction today, and I very much enjoyed it, Jonah.
It's almost embarrassing that it took you 20 years of life to see Pulp Fiction for the first time.
Well, I mean, I'm 19 for another, like, 12 days, so.
All right, then I understand.
Then it's understandable.
Yeah, it's classic Tarantino. It's, you know, it has that non-linear, hyper-violent, gratuitous use of the N-word vibe to it, and it's just a friggin' awesome movie.
I really enjoyed it. I didn't expect it to end the way it did, but that was kind of cool the way it did end. Because it ended, but it really had ended earlier.
Oh, better believe it.
Yeah, and
that inverted time sequence chronology. Damn, it's so good.
Yeah, there was much more depth to it, and I watched it. I didn't watch it all straight through. I watched the beginning of it, and then I had class, and then I watched the end of it. And so I was kind of, first I was like, wait, what? And then I started to piece everything together, and it made sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, don't ruin it for anyone who hasn't been, you know, alive since 1994.
Yeah. What's the thing they used to say about all books in high school? The main character dies at the end, something like that.
Yes.
And I guess there really is no main character.
Hamlet, the other guy. And so the point is made.
Yeah, no. So Jonah, what about you? What about your pop culture life so far has stuck out?
I've been thoroughly enjoying the new season of Dexter. I don't know if you watch Dexter, but...
I don't.
With cliffhanger that we were left off with at the end of last season has led itself to some serious dramatic tension in the first three episodes of this season. I think it's season six. I don't know. All these shows blend together. But, yeah, that's sort of been my pop culture fix lately. But, frankly, I've just been watching playoff baseball every night. So that's been fun.
Yeah.
Especially like that first round of the playoffs was as exciting as a first round of the playoffs as I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was. It was really awesome. I really enjoyed it. Gonna point to another meme. There was an Oprah meme, which I'm not sure if you saw, but it was
So many memes, so little time, my friend.
Exactly. It was Oprah, and on the top it said, "You get a game five, and you get a game five." And at the bottom, "Everyone gets a game five." I enjoyed it.
I love that. Game five is taped under your seat.
Yeah.
We've got a game five! That's how she would say it, too. And that's a bit I ripped off from 30 Rock. But that's how she would say it.
It is.
Screaming fans in her auditorium.
I don't know why, but I just imagined Jerry Seinfeld screaming about game fives.
What kind of game five is this?
What are we doing with all these game fives? That wasn't very good, but
I think mine was better.
Yours was better. It was so much better.
I watched just too much Seinfeld for any one normal human being. So
yeah, I do some good. I do a good impression of an obscure character from Family Guy.
Who?
He goes, "I know."
I love that. He's my only means of conveyance. But I guess I do spoil him. But yours, I agree there. In that case, yours was better.
Yes. So we're.
What kind of voice is this?
I was in the pool. No.
I was in the pool. Okay. Now, if we start, if you start this train of quoting Seinfeld, this episode will never end ever. We won't get to episode 8 because episode 4 is going to go on for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jonah. Your life, the next week or the next few days of your life, will they entail?
They will entail baseball, but not, yes, the baseball that you're thinking, but also the Carleton Ravens. We're in the middle of the CIBA, which is the Canadian Intercollegiate Baseball Association National Championship. So nice. My team is hosting schools from all over this great country of ours for a weekend of baseball to determine who reigns supreme. In the world of Canadian baseball. So we got that going on. How about you?
Well, first of all, I learned today about Terry Fox.
You just learned about Terry Fox?
Yeah, that's not a thing in America.
I just learned about Abraham Lincoln. was President Lincoln okay?
He was all right. I mean, he did a couple good things. But yeah, I learned about Terry Fox in an informative speech in my oral communication class.
He's a real Canadian hero.
He is an awesome guy, and I was almost brought to tears by what was said about him in the presentation today. In my life, I don't know. It's just Pop-Tarts, ramen noodles,
And scouting baseball.
Yeah, I really want to get back to scouting baseball. I actually did not go to Arizona as I had planned. I decided to make a trip home to see my family in New Jersey, I will be back to scouting before what's a good thing to do before? What can I say?
I don't know, man.
Before I finish watching the next episode of Mad Men.
There you go. That works.
But I'm kind of like putting myself in a box. Like I can't watch the next episode of Mad Men.
Well, you brought this upon yourself.
I could organize like a little league tournament and scout that.
There you go.
Okay.
It's never too early.
There are people who think that, though.
Yeah, I don't actually believe that, but yeah.
Like, there are people who are like, my kid's 10. I need to get some scouts to see him because he's going to be eligible for the draft in 2022.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some parents, man. All right, Jonah. I think it's time for us to say goodbye, and for our listeners to cry and have a very emotional, deep response.
Yes, cue the tears. And on that note, folks, thank you very much for tuning in. You've been enjoying the Tool of Ignorance podcast, and we will see you next week. Cheers.
Adios.
I need want you.